This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzad Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: U.S. officials say the White House will soon announce the new military aid package for Ukraine, which includes a Patriot missile battery and precision-guided bombs for fighter jets. An investigation reveals Twitter worked with the Pentagon to amplify propaganda about U.S. military activities in the Middle East, allowing fake accounts to push pro-Washington narratives. And Peru's Congress votes to move up general elections from 2026 to April 2024 in a bid to ease political tensions in the South American country. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's 9:30 a.m. here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. You're watching Press TV's World News. Our top story for this half hour: the U.S. is set to announce an additional military aid package for Ukraine, despite Russia's warnings against the delivery of advanced equipment to Kiev. According to U.S. officials, the $1.8 billion worth of new military aid will for the first time include a Patriot missile battery and precision-guided bombs. The officials described the details of the package on condition of anonymity. The U.S. has already provided Ukraine with more than $19 billion in military aid. Russia had earlier warned the U.S. against sending such advanced military equipment to Ukraine. Moscow said it would consider the move as a provocative step and that the equipment would be a legitimate target. There are also reports about the Ukrainian president's visit to Washington. If that happens, it would be Zelensky's first trip abroad since Russia launched its military offensive in Ukraine in February. Well, staying with Ukraine, French President Emmanuel Macron says his country has so far given rocket launchers and weapons to Ukraine and will send more in early 2023. In an interview aired on Tuesday, Macron said France has provided Ukraine with air defense batteries and equipment. Macron said he's working with the armed forces minister to send arms and ammunition again in the first quarter of the new year. He also said plans to deliver Caesar mobile artillery units will depend on negotiations with Denmark, which had ordered the guns from France. Macron said Copenhagen may agree to give at least some of the arms to Ukraine. Paris has provided Kiev with a wide array of weapons since the war began in Ukraine in late February. This, as Russia maintains more Western arms to Ukraine, will only prolong the war. European households and industries are suffering from soaring energy bills, with some businesses being forced to close down. Now, a new report suggests this is just the beginning of Europe's deepest crisis in decades. According to the report, the skyrocketing energy prices triggered by the war in Ukraine have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion.
The The skyrocketing energy prices have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion, according to a new report stating that the current situation as the fallout of the war in Ukraine is just the beginning of the deepest crisis in decades. Citing its calculations based on market data, a report published in Bloomberg said $1 trillion is a broad tally of more expensive energy for consumers and companies in European countries. However, that's just the beginning. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. Even with more facilities to import liquefied natural gas coming online, the market is expected to remain tight until 2026, when additional production capacity from the US to Qatar becomes available. That means no respite from high prices. The report also referred to more than $700 billion pledged by the European Union governments to protect consumers and companies from soaring prices, noting that aid is becoming increasingly unaffordable as interest rates are rising and economies are already in recession amid the war in Ukraine. Government fiscal capacity is already stretched. About half of European Union member states have debt exceeding the bloc's limit of 60% of gross domestic product. A rush to fill storage last summer, despite near-record prices, has eased the supply squeeze for now, but freezing weather is giving Europe's energy system its first real test this winter. Last week, Germany's network regulator warned that not enough gas is being saved and two of five indicators, including consumption levels, have become critical. With supply tight, businesses and consumers have been asked to reduce usage. According to the International Energy Agency, the EU managed to curb gas demand by 50 billion cubic meters this year. But the region still faces a potential gap of 27 billion cubic meters in 2023. That assumes Russian supplies drop to zero and Chinese LNG imports return to 2021 levels. The main source of pipeline gas from Russia to Western Europe was Nord Stream, which was damaged in an act of sabotage in September. The region is still receiving a small amount of Russian supplies through Ukraine, but heavy shelling of energy infrastructure by the Kremlin puts the route at risk. Without this gas line, refilling storage will be challenging. Also, LNG imports into Europe are at record levels and new floating terminals are opening in Germany to receive the fuel. Government-backed buying has helped Europe attract cargoes away from China. But colder weather in Asia and a potentially strong economic recovery after Beijing eased COVID restrictions could make that more difficult. Chinese gas imports are likely to be 7% higher in 2023 than this year. Beijing has started securing LNG supplies for next year, putting it in direct competition with Europe for spare shipments. China isn't Europe's only problem. Other Asian countries are moving to procure more gas. Japan, the world's top LNG importer this year, is even considering setting up a strategic reserve, with the government also looking to subsidize purchases. For the likes of Germany, which rely on affordable energy to make products from cars to chemicals, high costs mean losing competitiveness to the US and China. That puts pressure on Chancellor Olaf Scholz's administration to maintain support for the economy. The challenge is finding the balance between keeping factories running and homes heated in the near term.
EU member states have finally reached a deal on setting a price cap of 180 euros per megawatt hour on liquefied natural gas. The deal includes a package of measures to help the members protect their citizens and businesses from extreme price volatility. The Kremlin, however, says the cap is an attack on market pricing.
The Kremlin has lashed out at a decision by the European Union to put a price cap on natural gas in order to supposedly deprive Russia of funds to continue the war against the neighboring Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said on Monday that the decision was an attack on market pricing mechanisms. Peskov's criticism came after EU energy ministers agreed to trigger a cap if gas prices exceed 180 euros per megawatt hour for 3 days on the Dutch Tidal Transfer Facility gas hub's front-month contract, which serves as the European benchmark. The price cap can be triggered starting from February 15, 2023. Reuters reported citing a document detailing the final deal. Three EU officials were cited by Reuters as saying that the Netherlands and Austria abstained from voting on the decision. Both countries had resisted the cap during negotiations, fearing it could disrupt Europe's energy markets and compromise Europe's energy security. The EU officials added, Germany voted to support the deal despite having raised concerns about the policy's impact on Europe's ability to attract gas supplies in price-competitive global markets. The deal followed months of debate on the idea and two previous emergency meetings that failed to clinch an agreement among countries that disagreed on whether a price cap would help or hinder Europe's attempts to contain the energy crisis. Poland, however, welcomed the agreement, saying it would be an end to what it called market manipulation by Russia and Gazprom. Russia's war in Ukraine started in late February, with Moscow saying that it was aimed at defending the pro-Russian population in the eastern Ukrainian regions of Luhansk and Donetsk against persecution by Kyiv. The cap is also aimed at punishing Russia for cutting off most of its gas deliveries to EU countries in reaction to the sanctions that the bloc has slapped on Moscow over the war.
Elsewhere, an investigation based on Twitter's internal files shows the social media platform helped the U.S. military amplify its online propaganda campaigns about its activities in West Asia. According to the probe, finding Twitter created a special whitelist in 2017 to grant accounts run by the U.S. Central Command more visibly, that is. In some cases, the accounts even used fake profiles and bios to give the impression that they were run by civilians in West Asia. At the top of the campaign's agenda was spreading criticism of Iran and showing support for the U.S.-backed and Saudi-led war on Yemen. The investigation, which was launched after Elon Musk took over as Twitter CEO in October, says the aid for U.S. military continued until at least May of this year. The company has claimed for years that it makes a great effort to detect and thwart government-backed covert propaganda campaigns worldwide. Peru's Congress has voted to move up general elections from 2026 to April 2024 to ease political tensions in the South American country. Earlier on Tuesday, the electoral jury gave Congress a provisional green light to bring the elections forward. Lawmakers voted 93-30 with one abstention to make the change to the electoral calendar. The measure stipulates that in July 2024, the country's interim president, Dina Boluarte, handed over power to the winner of the elections. Peru has been embroiled in violent protests since the removal from office and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo earlier this month. Castillo was trying to dissolve Congress and rule by decree after lawmakers sought to impeach him. At least 21 people have so far died in clashes with security forces. Boluarte took office on December 7th, shortly after Castillo's ouster. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign ministry strongly denounces a recent meeting between former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the leader of the Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist group known as the MKO. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the meeting further proves Washington's cooperation with the murderers of 17,000 Iranians, the Iranian official said, by whitewashing terrorism and shamefully sanctifying the MKO leader. U.S. officials have laid bare the false face of American human rights. Kanani said the U.S. appeal to the MKO terrorists is aimed at exerting pressure on the Islamic Republic. He said the White House will remain legally and internationally responsible for violating the rights of Iranians. In the meeting with the MKO's leader on Saturday, Pompeo reiterated support for the terrorist group. The former U.S. Secretary of State picked the leader of the terrorist group as Iran's president. Iran has announced plans to expand its nuclear energy program in line with its rights under the JCPOA. That says the Vienna talks over the revival of the 2015 deal has faced a standoff, Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boost for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That's a wrap for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The night of Yalda, the longest night of the year. The night which falls between 21st and 22nd of December, known as the night of Yalda or the night of Chelle, in Iranian culture, and celebrated by Iranians for thousands of years, is the longest night of the year. Symbolically, the night of Yalda represents the birth of light and brightness. The festivity of Yalda in the Northern Hemisphere, the northern half of planet Earth, celebrates the longest night of the year, the end of autumn and the start of winter, and the fact that days become steadily longer after the passage of the night of Yalda. Traditionally, all members of an Iranian family, often an extended family, gather round on the night of Yaldar, the night of 21st of December until the morning of 22nd of December, and spend the night in each other's company, reading poetry, such as Ferdowsi's Shahnameh or the Divan of Hafez, with elder members of the family telling stories and fables for the children and young ones, eating fruits and particularly pomegranates and watermelons, and also eating a variety of dried fruits and nuts. Stay with us as we tell you more about this wonderful, quintessentially Iranian festivity. Yaldar is a word derived from the ancient Syrian language, meaning birth. Shab-e Yaldar, also known as Yaldar Night, is celebrated on the last day of autumn, the 30th of Azar on the Iranian solar calendar. Symbolically, the night of Yaldar represents the birth of light and brightness. Our forefathers celebrated the night of Yaldar with the night of Chelle, reading poetry, literature, and stories until the early hours of the morning and until daybreak. Clearly, the family unit and the extended family is very important to Iranians, and the night of Yaldar is a wonderful opportunity for all members of an extended family to gather round and celebrate this night together. In the weeks prior to the night of Yaldar, Iranians do a lot of shopping and prepare themselves for the festivity. Items which are sought after include dried nuts and fruits, pistachios, almonds and raisins, pomegranates and watermelons. This year, although the weather is not very cold and there has been no sign of snow, nonetheless, long shopping queues were quite common in the weeks leading up to the night of Yaldar in most Iranian towns and cities. This year's celebration of Yaldar Night is particularly significant, given the fact that during the past 2 or 3 years, because of the coronavirus pandemic, families have been more reluctant to get together. The night of Yaldar, or the night of Chelle, is the longest and darkest night of the year. It marks the night opening of the initial 40-day period of the 3-month winter season, from which the name Chelle, or 40th, derives. There are altogether 3 40-day periods, 1 in summer and 2 in winter. The 2 winter periods are known as the Great Chelle period, from the 1st of Day to the 11th of Bahman on the Iranian solar calendar, 40 full days, followed by the small Chelle period, from 10th of Bahman to 30th of Bahman on the Iranian solar calendar. The Yaldar Night Festival is celebrated in Iran and other historically Iranian-influenced regions, including the Republic of Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. The longest and darkest night of the year is a time when friends and family gather together to eat, drink and read poetry, especially the Divan of Hafez and Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, until well after midnight. The night of Yaldar has been registered on UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage. The night of Yaldar, or the night of Chelle, has been added as the new inscription on UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage by the suggestion of the Islamic Republic of Iran and Afghanistan. This adds another chapter to the age-old friendship between the two ancient neighboring civilizations. The UNESCO fact sheet proudly characterizes this ancient event as a mirror of cultural identity, hospitality, peaceful coexistence, friendship, and cultural diversity, highlighting its unique characteristics that have greatly and positively influenced the world's culture. In Iranian culture, we greatly value the time that family members spend next to each other. This is very important for Iranians. The fifth infallible successor to the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, has quoted the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as saying, "To all those members of my ummah present, and to all those yet to be born, to all future generations until Judgment Day, I recommend get together with your family and relatives, even if it takes 1 year to walk the distance between you, because spending time together with your relatives and family members has been designated by the Almighty Lord as part of Islam, as part of religion."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Revelations from the battlefield.
Part 2.
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq War Diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. Were these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers? Or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans and those that come after us draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home?
What the Army found after looking at thousands and thousands of deployments is that repeated deployments push you down the spectrum towards negative outcomes. Does that mean that if I went to Iraq for 12 months, I would come back a murderer? No, it doesn't. But does that mean that someone who might have been married and never had a problem with alcohol might get divorced and have a problem with alcohol? Or might get arrested for assault or something like that? Yes. And can some people get shoved even farther down the line or start farther down the line and get shoved even more? A lot of these guys that I wrote about are kids who didn't do that well in high school. They saw the Army as an opportunity because their other opportunities had been shut off. And they were good at what they were doing. A number of them said to me, you've got to be a little crazy to be in the infantry. And a lot of times the crazy guys are the ones who do the best in Iraq. But when they come back, they are already set up pretty low on the negative outcome spectrum. And when they start dealing with depression, PTSD, substance abuse, it's game over.
Kenneth Eastridge was open with Army recruiters about his criminal history, including a homicide charge as a juvenile. Several recruiters turned him away. But with enough persistence, Eastridge was able to convince one recruiter to enlist him despite his record of violence.
A lot of them were just kicked out of the Army for being bad soldiers because they were melting down emotionally. And once they were kicked out, they were sort of cut loose and had nowhere to go. They started drinking. They were carrying weapons all the time because they were extremely paranoid. They started using a lot of drugs. You put those things together with the training of an infantry soldier, and it's not long before somebody gets killed.
Courtney Lockhart enlisted in the Army after high school as a computer operator, but was deployed to Iraq as a foot soldier. Like many soldiers, he did not want to go to Iraq. His traumatic experiences in Iraq, including regular roadside bomb attacks on his brigade and the deaths of close friends, haunted Courtney upon his return from deployment. Like many of the soldiers in his unit, Courtney showed many of the signs of post-traumatic stress. He began smoking marijuana to calm his nerves from nightmares and paranoia, and was discharged from the military for marijuana use and violence, but was never screened for mental illness. In 2008, Courtney Lockhart abducted an 18-year-old girl from her college dorm, robbed and attempted to rape her before killing her with a handgun. Lockhart confessed and was convicted of the murder. jury in his case recommended life imprisonment without parole, but the judge sentenced Lockhart to death by lethal injection.
One of the things that we've learned is it's not, and the military has learned over the number of decades, it's not so easy to get people to kill. Until relatively recently, the majority of soldiers in combat never fired their weapons. Since World War II, this has become a major preoccupation of the military.
Surveys of American soldiers who served in World War II showed that only 15 to 20% actually fired their weapons, even when ordered to do so.
For most of us, it's very, very hard to shoot to kill somebody. So the military goes through great effort to teach soldiers to become killers, to desensitize them. And that's what basic training is about. There's all kinds of chants that are rather horrific about killing people because it's very, you have to get these people to not think about people, that they're killing people.
As a result of these findings, the U.S. military intensified its training and conditioning of soldiers to fire at and kill the enemy. Some soldiers report they find it difficult to switch off this aggressive, vigilant mentality when they return home.
If a soldier reports mental illness or problems that they're having, that can have an impact on their career. I mean, if, let's say, an officer goes in and tells his superior that I'm feeling a little off today, I think I might be losing it, I'm having a difficulty, you know, maintaining a touch with reality. Well, are you going to give that officer a job that requires him to handle weapons, to handle increased responsibilities? Are you going to promote that officer? You're not. It's going to be career damaging to self-report that. And that's where I think you see a lot of increased rates of suicide, of alcoholism, and a lot of these other acting out scenarios that we've seen from soldiers who have returned after facing those kinds of stress.
You come back and you're supposed to fit into civilian society. You know, either people want to ask, what's it like being in war? And you don't want to talk, or they don't want to hear about it. They want you to come back and, you know, hug the kids, love the wife, and you're just not quite there, and you don't feel you fit in. And so it can magnify things because you've left this whole life. You're trying to return to it, but you're not quite there for many of them. And then you've got the whole set of experiences. You've got the fact that you're on alert all the time. A car backfires and it's like you're back on the streets of Basra. And it's just very, very hard for a lot of people to live with this.
One of the things that shocked me about learning about these crimes, about, you know, maybe a dozen soldiers all getting arrested for senseless shootings, basically, is how easy it is. It seems like a long way to go from being a law-abiding, normal person to a murderer, but really it isn't. Okay, these are guys who have extensive weapons training. They know how to not only use a weapon, but at least all the ones I'd spoken to had killed people in Iraq. One of the guys had killed over 60 people.
In the wars that we've had recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have, as you do in counterinsurgency type situations, you have an enemy who can't be distinguished from the civilian population. You don't know who's your enemy. So you're on a constant alert. You're fearing people on a daily basis. You're sometimes killing people without being completely certain as to who they were. Because that's the nature of these types of actions.
Now, take a young man with that kind of training, that kind of experience. Bring him home. Give him lots of alcohol, because that's what they did to medicate themselves. Give them some drugs. They were looking for the high of combat, and a lot of times they replaced it with crystal meth, cocaine. Give them a loaded weapon that they carry at all times. And that's what these guys did. For some reason, they didn't feel safe when they came home. And the thing that made them feel safe was carrying a loaded weapon, and they all did it. I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of people in Colorado Springs right now who are doing it. Now, you combine all those things and add a little stress, a fight with somebody, someone cutting you off, a bad day. And it's very easy to kill somebody. And then you've crossed the line, and it's a very thin line between thinking it and doing it and having done it.
John Turner served as a Marine infantryman in Iraq, including tours in Fallujah and Ramadi. Since returning from war, he has become a peace activist and a vocal advocate for healing of soldiers' mental wounds.
You know, it's so easy to send somebody off to do dirty work, but come home and there's nothing, man. There's no purification, right? There's no ceremony to welcome you back to being home. And it's a shame. And it took me a long time to realize that I was home. You know, I've been back for 6 years, almost 6 years now. And I've still never had a proper welcoming ceremony.
A lot of the guys that I've talked to said that they wished there was something more sort of structured and removed from society that was sort of a halfway house in between combat and home. You know, they feel, especially guys that go back and forth every couple of years, are just yo-yoed between two worlds and find that they belong in neither.
It's a very hard thing to do, because even when they try and set up programs, they have it on the ships coming back, and there was a period where they put people on ships rather than airplanes to give them a period of decompression. But all the soldiers want to do is get home to their families. And, you know, so even if you set up programs, they don't want to be thinking about it. And it's a very hard task. You don't just turn on a killer and then turn them off.
All of a sudden, you're in theater and you're being blown up. And then 2 days later, you're looking at your family on, you know, in the green. It's a wild experience. And you don't care, because all you want to do is get home. That's all that matters, is getting home. But what is so important is that time in between there to talk the stories over with your friends, with your buddies that you were in those experiences with. And that's got to be one of the hardest transitions in the world, you know?
The story, I think, touched me more than any others in these interviews was the story of a guy named John Needham. He was a kid from California. Actually, he was a professional surfer before he joined the Army. And he joined the Army pretty late in 2004, when it was clear that the Iraq War was going pretty badly. And he thought to himself, well, here it is. Here's a time when my country actually needs me, and I'll sign up. And by all accounts, he was the best soldier in his platoon, the right hand of the lieutenant, big, strong, smart, good-looking. Everyone liked him. According to him, on their tour in Baghdad, his platoon went dark. They started doing things that he thought were unnecessary. They started, mutilating dead bodies and putting them on their Humvee and then driving around the neighborhood, which they suspected was full of insurgents, and they were probably right, and saying, you're next. They started killing people that he thought didn't deserve to be killed. A kid on a bicycle, a guy walking down the street, and they would cover it up. And he didn't want to do that, and he turned against his platoon, and they turned against him, and he felt trapped in this position where he didn't know there was no way out. It eventually drove him crazy, and he tried to shoot somebody in his platoon. After that happened, they sent him back to Fort Carson, because The model of that battalion was, if someone starts acting crazy and they're too dangerous to be in Baghdad, send them back to Colorado Springs. That's obviously a very dangerous solution for everybody. He got back to Colorado Springs and they told him they were going to court-martial him for trying to shoot someone in his platoon, someone he believed was doing something very illegal. Fortunately, his father, who is a well-educated, retired Army officer, intelligence officer, intervened and said, look, this kid doesn't need to be punished. He needs help. And so they got him into treatment for PTSD, but it wasn't effective. It wasn't effective, and his father finally brought him home after he retired from the Army. He couldn't hold a job. He just stayed inside all day, and he would have these flashbacks, usually during the middle of the night, where he would take off all his clothes and think he was back in Iraq, and he would hide behind furniture, thinking that there were insurgents everywhere. You know, his father didn't know what to do. He tried to get him committed to the VA hospital because he needed inpatient care, but there was no room, and he didn't qualify. And eventually, John Needham beat his girlfriend to death. He was arrested. He got out on bail, miraculously. His father put up, I think, about $200,000 in bail. And he later died under very uncertain circumstances of a drug overdose, whether it was intentional or accidental. But he was a guy who was so together, was such a sort of a someone who had everything, who was just totally undone by his experience until he had nothing left. And I think about him all the time and how it could have been really different for him.
Everything that I've gone through, everything that my friends have gone through, I've forgiven. You know, and it's just, I can keep saying that word and hopefully it has set in somewhere in every person, you know, forgive, 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 and learn. It doesn't matter what someone did to you, it's not gonna make a difference. And there's a huge split between veterans. I don't wanna label people as being pro-war veterans or anti-war veterans, but there is like a split in the middle. And then there's the people who are just hush-hush and don't talk about their experience. And I've had a couple of friends that, people that they knew in college didn't even know that they were a veteran for like 3 years of knowing them, you know? And that all goes back to being afraid to tell your story to somebody. But our stories are what matter. You know, this is really what is going to change our future and change our lives for our children and our grandchildren. And every generation to come is, they have to know of our mistakes. You know, just as much as we have to know of our mistakes and where we've made faults in our lives. Because if we keep doing the same over and over again, everyone is still going to be suffering.
We didn't have to go into Iraq. We didn't have to be there. We didn't have to do all the things that we did there. And we did. And one of the reasons that we did is I think that the American public, which is reasonable and averse to war but not opposed to it, was sold a bum bill of goods. If you had said to them, look, we're going to have guys like this, guys like the Lethal Warriors. We're going to have it for decades. It doesn't go away, and we don't really have a good way of treating it. I think people would have given things a second thought. And that's really why I tried to do what I do, is that if you don't have all the information, you can't make the right decision. And I don't think we did. And I hope next time we do.
We have seen the destruction war brings to all sides. We have struggled to comprehend the horrors of war inflicted through more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, or envision the many years of healing these millions of soldiers and civilians require. legacy and fallout of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars belong to my generation and those that will come after us. We have grown up watching these wars unfold through events like Abu Ghraib, Haditha, and the Stryker 5 killings. We have seen the million U.S. soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan return home to face increased unemployment, high rates of alcohol and drug dependence, mental trauma, and suicide as a result of their experiences in battle. A number of factors contributed to the misconduct and crimes committed by members of the American military, both abroad and upon returning home. Some soldiers should not have been in the military or in conflict zones in the first place, whether due to behavioral issues or underlying mental disorders. What lessons should my generation and future generations of Americans take from Iraq and Afghanistan? To better screen who we put in uniform and train to kill? To properly train and supervise members of the military and maintain high standards for conduct? To better recognize and treat trauma from military service? All of these things, clearly. But the common element in these horrific events is war itself. Fighting better supervised wars with a better screened and better trained military will do little to shield against the horror of war as a traumatic experience. Even as the U.S. welcomes its soldiers home from Iraq and Afghanistan and realizes the damage done to thousands of its own, some of our leaders call for additional wars. So the question remains, have we really learned the cost of war?
In the limelight.
Major anti-NATO rallies have hit France recently. French protesters have called for a review of France's policies towards the US-led bloc and Moscow and denounced anti-Russia sanctions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, crowds of protesters took to the streets of the French capital recently to protest France's policies towards Russia and the nation's NATO membership. The large-scale rally was organized by the right-wing Les Patriotes, or the Patriots Party, led by Florian Philippot, the former deputy head of Marine Le Pen's National Rally. Philippot has been organizing protests dubbed the Resistance since autumn, demanding that France leave NATO and the EU, as well as criticizing President Emmanuel Macron's economic and foreign policies. Recently, demonstrators were seen carrying banners and placards that read, "France must leave NATO, Macron's impeachment, and resistance." They were also seen waving France's national flag and chanting, "Ursula, shut up," a reference to the EU Commission head, Ursula von der Leyen. Protests in which Philippot himself took part were triggered in particular by the high energy prices that have forced small businesses across France into closure. He explained to Rob Lee Video News Agency, "We must stop the anti-Russia sanctions because that does not serve peace.
there, but brings misery here, he said. Photos and videos published by the politician on social media showed a large crowd marching through the streets of central Paris. French officials have not commented on the rally and provided no official figures as to the number of demonstrators. The French media mostly ignored the event as well. According to the website of Les Patriotes, similar rallies were held in September and October. Protest also occurs as neighboring Belgium saw a massive demonstration joined by over 16,000 people in Brussels earlier this week. Thousands took to the streets in the Belgian capital recently to demand a freeze on spiking energy prices and better pay amid high inflation in Belgium and the EU. Gas and electricity prices have skyrocketed in Europe as the economic strain caused by the COVID-19 was further aggravated by the fallout of EU sanctions on Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. Russian energy supplies to the bloc were then further reduced amid the EU's attempts to rid itself of Moscow's energy imports altogether.